The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wiss.
Let's take everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 110. Very interesting guest we have with us today. It's Andrew Thrift, all the way from Australia.
Hey, guys.
Are you still in Bris Vegas?
Yeah, mate. I wouldn't go anywhere else. Maybe it's because it's all I know, but, you know, pretty happy for now.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. All right. And we also have Mikey from Chicagoland.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent. All right. So let's get some of the stuff out of the way. We've got a new sponsor today. It is Cambium. It's a little wireless manufacturer. I'm not sure if you've heard of those guys. They're running a special, and I'm just going to give you kind of the cliff notes here. It's one is this special. It's kind of a bundled package. It's a price discount, so $6,000 value. You get it for just under $2,000. You get 6 months of VISP.NET automation and billing. On the back end, they're also supplying you with RF Elements twist horns, and then 2 hours of one-on-one time with an EPMP network engineers, right? And the idea being there's no sales pitch. It's just one-on-one. You ask them questions, ask them about their experiences, ask them anything you want in there. I think there's also a CN heat trial if you're interested. So from what I understand, this is like a bundle that's probably going to be really good for the new WISP or somebody looking to jump head first in there with Cambium. So we're going to have a link in the show notes. Pop in there, have a look, and good luck with your Cambium adventures. So also, as far as...
On that, just a tangent off of that.
Uh-oh.
Tangent. I've seen a lot of chatter on the AFMUG mailing list about CN Heat, and there's a lot of people saying that it's pretty good. That the projection data that it uses will, like, if there's dormers on your roof, it will properly shade them as if there's coverage available there or not.
Oh, that's baller, man.
Like it's, I mean, I probably wouldn't do it because I'm poor. I guess cheap is probably more accurate than poor.
Yeah.
But it's really good from what I hear.
Excellent. So speaking of sponsors, you patrons out there listening are probably one of our most important sponsors. And this week we have a new one. It's Jared Twomey. T-W-O-M-E-Y. Twomey? You guys taking a stab at that?
The guy I know whose last name is spelled like that is Toomey.
Toomey. Jared Toomey. There you go. Excellent. So thank you, Jared Toomey. You go to patreon.com/yourbrotherswisp. Throw us a couple of bones, and you get access to the patron-only Slack. I don't know that he's been real active in there yet. I don't think he's... I think he just got access this morning, so I don't think I've seen him pop in. Maybe he's trying to enjoy his weekend without forcing work into it. Let's see, what else? We also are still sponsored by Sonar, sonar.software. It's a scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. So you want to hear more about them, or rather read more about them, go to sonar.software.
And off of the Sonar thing... If anyone is observant of me in various online discussions, mailing lists, forums, Facebook groups, they will know that just because a vendor sponsors us, I don't give them a pass.
In no way, shape, form, or fashion is this saying that they are the best in the world. But if it was something that was complete garbage, we would not have them on as a sponsor, no matter how much they were trying to pay. So both of those are definitely leaders in the industry. So get out there and take a look.
Oh, yeah. The three companies I'm involved with from a management perspective all use Sonar to some degree.
Yeah.
So.
But I do like the idea that we're not beholden to our sponsors. So that is definitely a good key point to put in there. Well, we have some very thrift-centric stuff today. So I'm wondering if we should save that for just a minute, or should we go ahead and get out of the way? What's your schedule like, Thrifty?
Oh, I've got plenty of time, mate. We'll talk about the other topics.
All right, because there's not a lot of stuff in there. I noticed that Cisco, I think it was like a week ago or something like that, they sent out probably a mass press release. I'm not sure. It ended up in my inbox anyway. But they are now offering their certification tests online. And I think they're doing it through like Pearson View, where they, you like set up a webcam and they watch you while you're taking the test, or something akin to that. I'm not exactly sure. So at least you can, because I mean, at first they were saying, you know what, we're extending everybody's certification, I think, for like 6 months or something like that. And now they're saying, hey, you can actually go online to cert and recert. So that's really, I think that's pretty cool. I think that's forward looking too, because we don't know how long this shelter in place kind of stuff's going to be, right? So
yeah, that's right.
I would assume the, Cisco probably makes Pearson a lot view, off of that, huh?
The Pearson View tester opens full screen. It's like a special browser that they use, so I imagine it will do, work the same way.
Gotcha.
It just takes over your machine and you can't run anything else, and just turns on the webcam and makes sure you're not doing anything too dodgy.
You got a little earpiece in. Person. I read every question out loud. Don't worry about it. Yeah. So that's interesting. I'm curious who else is going to follow suit. You know, is Microtech going to start letting people do that? Is, I really hope Red Hat starts letting people do that, because I'm starting to really kill myself on this Ansible stuff for sure. And I wanted to certify. You know what? I heard that there's something like a 10% pass rate on the Red Hat certification.
Wow.
And they said 20% of the people who take the test, I think, are Red Hat employees, and it's still only 10% pass rate. So it's pretty bad.
No pressure, right?
Yeah, well, they were like, well, you can still study for the certification, you just can't take the test, you know, and then you can take it later. I was like, are you kidding me? I was like, 5 minutes after I've studied for the certification, everything's going to fall out of my head. You're killing me. You're killing me. So I really hope that everybody starts kind of moving to some kind of online format for certification, because I want to keep, you know, I want to keep pushing myself. I don't want to have to like do some kind of weird delay limbo thing. I don't know. But if Pearson,
so you're saying, doing it,
hopefully there'll be an option.
So you're saying then that that the Red Hat cert might be the only cert that's worth anything?
To me, right this second.
well, you know, I was going from the aspect of it only being like a, you know, 10% pass rate. That means it must be challenging. It's not you know, there's a bunch of people just you know, taking online dumps and then just walking in and, hey, you know, I've got my CCNA. Oh, great. So is everybody else.
Yeah, that's my understanding, that it's an extremely hands-on test. So
yeah, you need field experience.
Yeah, they really want you to. I think they were talking about, well, never mind. I don't know how much of that stuff I can actually say out loud. But a lot of Red Hat employees went in to take a test, and not very many of them passed. So fairly difficult. So I'm keen to kill myself and get that certification. I like doing that stuff. But I don't know. Are you still doing certifications, Thrift, or is that kind of not part of your life anymore?
I went really hard. I think 1 year I spent $16,000 on doing certifications.
Wow.
At one point. So I did a whole bunch of Extreme ones and Cisco ones and MikroTik ones all in 1 year. And since then I have done absolutely nothing. That was probably in 2011, I think I did all those. And I just left it until now. But now that I work for a vendor, you have to do them. So, yeah, I've done a couple of Fortinet certifications just internally when I was in Thailand. And I've just done all of the training for the AWS Cloud Practitioner as well. That looks pretty easy. I'm yet to do the exam, but I'm fairly confident I'm going to pass that one.
Is that a Pearson View test for you guys?
The AWS Cloud Practitioner is not. It's just through the AWS portal. It's really just a sales type certification more than anything. Like, there's a bit of technical stuff in there, but to be honest, any grad could pass it without much effort. I think it's pretty straightforward. Yeah. But cool. Beyond this, I'm going to do a bunch more internal Fortinet certifications. So we've got one called NSE8, which covers every single product we make. And since we've got 40 products, it's fairly hard.
Gotcha.
CCIE level hard kind of thing. Yeah.
So you mentioned Fortinet. You're I don't know what the terminology there is. Are you an SE? Is that what they call them?
Yeah, so we used to be called SEs, or sales engineers. However, they've changed it recently to enterprise solution architects to kind of differentiate and make it clear that we're there to design solutions for customers. Because when we were at SEs, a lot of customers perceived that we were there for pre-sales and post-sales. So we'd get a lot of after-sales queries, like an overwhelming amount of them.
Gotcha.
Yeah, whereas now this kind of clarifies that a bit more. It's good so far, the change.
That's cool. So you said you have to have some technical knowledge over the entire product line. Do you guys have some engineers or some SE flavors that are more specialized, like inch deep
model? We do. So they haven't changed the name of those yet. They're called CSEs, or Consulting Systems Engineers. They're usually the engineers that have got a very specific knowledge set. So we've got one guy in Sydney who has come from a service provider background, e.g. he was working for a very large vendor that's strong in that space. And we poached him over, and he effectively looks after the mobile carriers. So he's a CSE around mobile technologies and that. So he's dealing with all those sort of IPsec tunnels out to RAN nodes on LTE networks, and he knows LTE inside out. And we've got other guys that have just been with the company for 4 or 5 years, and they know a bunch of our products really, really well. So, yeah, we've got CSEs. We also got SMEs, or subject matter experts. So I'm the subject matter expert for DDoS, for example, and NAC, Network Access Control. And there's subject matter experts for most of the products, just because there's so many of them.
Right.
You just can't know everything.
Yeah. So you end up being a SME on one thing, but you still really need to know the whole portfolio pretty well. Is that kind of...
Yeah, you need to know the base products. So we've got three base products, or core products. Everybody needs to know those in depth. And then beyond that, we've got what we call enhanced tech. So those are additional products like the client, the FortiClient, which is like an endpoint protection product. You don't need to be an expert on it. You need to know what it is and what it does, but that's about it. Yeah.
That's cool. I'm still not 100% sure on all of the employee names inside of Red Hat, like on the sales side, because there's like account executive.
You don't know all of them yet?
God.
Oh, geez.
There's like 7,000?
Yeah, so starting from like most sales to least sales, I think it starts like account executive, and then you go SA, and SAs are like inch deep, mile wide. They know like all the product portfolio, but very light. And then you go like an SSP or C, and they are more technical on fewer products. And then you go to something else, and then you go to me, which is SSA, Specialist Solutions Architect. So I know one product very well, and even inside that product I'm specializing in networking. So it's like there's a lot of variance in there amongst who knows what. And so it's so funny that it's like the SSC might know Ansible pretty well, but it's like, at what point do I pick up from them or hand? Apparently they make requests and then we go in, so I don't have to figure that stuff out. It's just, you know, when we get called, we go. It's just sort of an interesting... Oh no, I remember what it is. They're supposed to sell the business value of the product. I'm supposed to sell the technical value of the product. So they prove it business wise okay, this is a good decision, and then I prove it technically and I show them how it actually functions and works.
It's pretty structured, Greg.
It's all weird and hard for me to keep straight in my head right now. Like, for the longest time, I couldn't remember the word specialist. I could just remember solutions architect. And I was like, it's supposed to be my job title. I think I probably need to memorize that. So it's getting complicated. But you've been in the vendor realm for a long time, right? In and out and then back in?
I have. I was in the vendor realm back in the early 2000s, so probably 2003 through 2007, I was in Vendorland, representing a number of different vendors like Lucent, Fortinet, Fluke Networks, a bunch of different ones. And then I kind of felt like I was losing my ability to actually deliver things and do technical work. So I went back into reseller land for about 11 years. And I forgot what Vendorland was like. So when I came back into it, it was a massive, massive shock. It's just so different from anything else in IT.
In a good way?
Yeah, in a good way. It's just a different set of skills. So, like, for example, when I had to do my first PowerPoint, I was just like, what do I do? I've forgotten how to do this. Like, I don't even know how to drive this program. When do I talk? Yeah, and there's a few tricks that I'd mastered previously, like reading ahead in your PowerPoints and making sure you're familiar with the slides and that none of them contradict each other or anything like that, which I've completely forgotten about. So, yeah, it's just a different set of skills.
That's cool. Yeah. That's cool. I've been working on, so I've been shadowing people this last week, a couple of different folks, right? So I'm supposed to kind of get an idea of the flow and the way things go. And what I've determined is I've got to find my own sort of story associated with Ansible, you know, the automation piece, which is, I mean, anybody who's been doing network engineering, I think it's going to be pretty easy for you to figure out painful moments in your life and then talk about how automation could have really made those better. But, you know, selling the other person, I don't know whether it's going to happen or not. But that, the, to me, that's it feels fun and kind of exciting, the idea of that, to figure out what they need to hear, want to hear, and then delivering it to them. You know, I assume you do the same thing, walking in thinking this product is really going to solve a problem for them, right? It's, I'm not selling something to them. I'm kind of giving them something.
Storytelling.
Yeah. I'm going to make their life better in some way. So it's an interesting way of looking things.
It is.
Excellent. Well, I could rattle on about this because you've got a lot of experience and I would love to pick your brain, but let's move on.
We can talk about it offline, Greg.
Excellent. Excellent. I'll do it. Not just get tips about hair gel and or do you use like a pomade? What is it?
I
mean, what...
I think you call it a pomade in the States. It's like a paste.
Excellent. Not that I have any need for it, but it's quite fascinating to remember what it was like to have hair at one point. So let's get into the stuff we actually brought you here for. There is a plethora, I would say, Hefe, I would say there is a plethora of MikroTik stuff that's been announced. Not least of which, most important for me, is that Winbox 3.23 actually has Control-C, Control-A functionality, finally.
I didn't even know that, Greg. That's amazing.
For the longest time, you know, you would highlight something in Winbox, you'd hit Control-C, and you'd go over here and paste, and there'd be a whole bunch of other crap that you had copied a million years ago. So you'd have to remember to right-click and say copy, and I don't know that I can break myself of that habit. I'm so accustomed to doing
I'm definitely on autopilot for that one. Like, I don't even think now, it just happens.
Yeah. So it's cool. It's cool to think they are making incremental updates. But no, the real information is there's a lot of new hardware that's out, right?
Definitely is. So I guess this has been on the cards for a while. There's been rumors and people have found little snippets of code and binaries. And there's a guy in... I think he's in Hungary, Dunware, on the forums. He's pretty crazy. He pulls all the little binaries apart within Router OS and finds stuff, and occasionally MikroTik will troll us and put random characters in there to see what we pick up on. It's quite funny. Anyway, what they've added recently is the big new product is a CCR 2000 series. So previously we had the CCR 1000 series, which were, I think, the 1009, the 1036, and the 1072, and I think there's a 1016 as well. Those were based on a architecture from a small startup called Tylera. The architecture in those was pretty neat. I'll go into a bit more detail in a minute. But what we've got now is a CCR 2004 is the first product that MikroTik are announcing in the CCR 2000 series. It's quite a big departure in design. It's no longer using that Tylera processor. It's using an ARM processor, and not just an ARM processor. It's a 64-bit ARM processor. So this is the first 64-bit ARM platform that they've got. It looks pretty interesting. It's only got four cores, and those are 1.7 gigahertz cores. So it looks to be targeted really in the same sort of area that the CCR 1009 was and the 1016. The port configuration on it's pretty different. It's got, I think, 12 times 10 gigabit ports and 2 times 25 gigabit ports on the front of it. And those ports have shared bandwidth. So I think there's 50 gigabits to the system on a chip. So the processor's got 50 gigabits of capacity in and out. And then that's shared across the 170 gigabits worth of ports on the front of it.
Interesting. I see. I mean, it looks like the classic design. Like, looking at the box, I'm looking at the kind of the vendor stills here. And it's got dual power supply, which is nice.
Yep.
Are not hot swappable, but at least you have two in the box, right?
Yeah.
I also see a massive heat sink sticking out of the back of this thing.
Oh, on those power supplies, I did want to note that it is the same power supply setup as the CCR R2s, so you can take that plus or minus 48 volt power supply that's available, and it'll work in here as well.
Definitely will. So we've had that confirmed from Microtix, so you can swap these to the DC power supplies. It's pretty good that they've kept with that same form factor.
Yeah. I also noticed in the thread that we had going in Slack, you said that it can run version 6, but it does it in like a 32-bit emulation mode?
Correct. So on the data sheet, I'll just have a look. There's some throughput numbers, I think it is. Or is it? No, the RAM. The RAM is the giveaway. So it shows the RAM for version 6 as being 1792 megabytes, or for RouterOS v7 as being 4 gigabytes. And the reason for that is that when you run RouterOS v6 on these, it runs in a 32-bit emulation mode because the processors are natively 64-bit, and to run RouterOS v6, it has to emulate a different architecture. So I thought that was a bit funky. I'm surprised they didn't just make it v7 exclusive, but I guess... V7 still in beta, and that would be pretty brave if they did that. But at the same time, I think it's pretty brave to run V6 in emulation. So, yeah, I think your mileage may vary there a little bit to start with.
Gotcha. Well, I guess it just gives them a little bit more runtime on the product, so they can fab the hardware, get it out, and if version 7 hits market faster than they anticipated, then great for everybody. If not, they're still moving product, right?
That's right. The other interesting thing on this, there's two other little points that I'd like to mention now. So the price is $595 US, so that's similar to the CCR1009. It's a fairly low price for the performance that you're getting. The other one is it's using an Annapurna ARM processor. So these are the chips that Amazon Web Services design and manufacture in-house. This particular processor is actually used by a bunch of network-attached storage boxes from QNAP and I think Netgear as well. So the processor's been out since about 2015. It's a pretty mature processor, and Microtik are also familiar with the architecture because this is the same type of processor that the, it's called the 4011 and the 1100AH-X4 are running. It's just this is a 64-bit version of it with better I.O.
Gotcha. 64-bit processor. You said 4-core running at like 1.7 gigahertz?
That's right.
Right, so
and 4 gig of RAM,
and the BGP processing. You know, whenever it's building the rib, it does better with a single larger core, right?
That's right. So instead of having a 1 gigahertz or a 1.2 gigahertz core like the original CCR1000 series, this has a 1.7 gigahertz. But that's not all there is to it. So a lot of it is what's called the IPC, or instructions per clock performance. It's how many instructions it can perform per clock cycle. And the IPC on these new A57 ARM cores is significantly higher than the old PPC hybrid cores that the Tileras ran. So I think Mike did a test with the 4011s that was... just the performance on them was insane compared to the CCRs, and this will be even better again than those.
Gotcha. And that's just version 6, right? Version 7's got even better performance. So
it does. So the way version 7 works, I think there was a leaked demonstration with that, where effectively what it does is it runs a rib per pair. So each pair that you're connected to via BGP has a rib. The filters for that pair are processed in that rib, and then once it's finished processing those, it processes another set before it puts it into the master rib, and then that goes into the hardware forwarding information base. So it means that the individual pair processing can be done multi-threaded or multi-core. So each pair gets a core to process its routes, and then another core processes them into the central rib, or the main table, I guess you'd call it. And that performs a lot better. Coordinating that in software must be pretty interesting. But Microtik looked to have done it. So
yeah, good. I remember even in the leak test, it was really interesting because you could reset a single peer and your router didn't really hiccup, right? It was able to just Well, I mean, let's explain the difference between rib and fib and how that kind of correlates to how your router is going to perform.
So the rib is the routing information base. It's effectively, on most routers, is a single rib. It effectively stores the routes that have been communicated via BGP to the remote peers. The fib is the forwarding table. That's the actual table of where packets are forwarded. Now, on Linux, you just call that the main routing table or the kernel routing table. On other products, it will be a TCAM, so a dedicated ASIC that's designed to hold that table and do really fast lookups. Now, typically you have a rib and a fib separate, and the reason for that is the rib is quite dynamic. Routes are coming in, routes are going out. Decisions need to be made on those routes by processing them through the BGP algorithm. And then once that processing and those decisions have been made, they get pushed into the forwarding information base. So you want to keep the number of changes on that fib as low as possible, because otherwise you're going to have really flaky connectivity out of that router.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So rib is like you pull all the routes from all the different sources, right? So static routing, connected interfaces, yep. OSPF, BGP, and then you make best path decision and then you throw those into the fib, right?
That's exactly right, Greg. Now, in router ISV 6, they effectively didn't have a rib and a fib. It was just one giant rib. And if you've ever run full tables on a CCR, you're probably all too aware of the fact that you can have peer drop and then the routes won't disappear for, 15-odd minutes. And then that peer comes back or another peer comes back and you probably are not going to have routes within 15 minutes, so it's really, really important to use soft reconfiguration and a bunch of other little tricks in there to make it workable. But even then, it's only going to be so good and you're going to have issues with it. So this changed having a rib per peer as well as a central coordinating rib and then a separate fib again is going to bring about massive, massive performance improvements once V7 routing is out in the wild. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty insane. It seemed like for a long time they were trying to just let's throw more power at the problem, right? And then I guess we really hit a plateau where we'd be getting more and more powerful products and just not seeing that performance. And ultimately it came down to a rewrite of the engine, right?
Oh, exactly right. And this is not unique to MikroTik. I've done a lot of work with Juniper and Cisco for internet routing, and they have the same problems. Like people... It's funny, I hear people saying, oh, you need to buy a Cisco, it's going to fix this problem. And it's like, well, you've got to buy the right Cisco. If you just go and buy an ASR 1002, it's going to have exactly the same problem as a MikroTik. Or if you buy an MX104 or MX80 from Juniper, they've got an even smaller processor. Like they're the same sort of type of processor that's in the classic RB1100 single core, which I think is like a 1.2 gigahertz PPC. And that one little processor is processing everything. So you're going to see exactly the same problems on those products as you would on a MikroTik. The only solution is to go to much larger, more powerful cores, like the later Junipers and Ciscos did, or to start doing the per-peer ribs, which I believe both Cisco and Juniper have also started doing now. So MikroTik are going in the same direction as what's been proven with the other vendors.
That's good. Only for a fraction of the price, right?
Exactly right.
I don't think for $600 you could get a Juniper sales guy to call you.
No. he might call you and laugh, but that's about it.
I'm pretty sure that's what it costs for any 10 gig SFP.
Yeah. Now, I was talking with a few guys about this the other day. Is MikroTik actually don't have any competition in this kind of small router market, like for small ISPs. What competition do they have? I mean, Ubiquiti's had a crack at it, but they kind of, it wasn't a full-hearted effort that they put into it. And there's not much else out there. I mean, you really need to step up to big boy products like the Cisco ASR 9Ks or the Juniper MXs to get anything. You can try and use Juniper SRXs or Cisco ASR 920s and things like that, but really those are just a switch that's got some basic routing capabilities in them. They can't do full routing. You can't really use them as a border router, not like you can use a MikroTik. So they really don't have much competition, especially not in the price point that they're in. There's just nothing else out there.
You know, it's interesting you say that. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I would say, like, the closest thing I could think of is still going to be a big departure in, you know, going over to something from like Six Wind or Free Range Routing or whatever to get the software, but then you have to bring your hardware. You know,
that's
it's
right.
Not, you know, it isn't that little convenient box.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Great. Ease of use as well, right? I mean, to me, that kind of factors into it. Nobody's going to look at Winbox for the very first time and think to themselves, wow, this is easy to use. But once you get your head wrapped around it, your workflow is so fast on that stuff. But you're right.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would have, you know, probably 5 years ago, if you said who, you know, that's such an interesting question. Who competes in this space? I had never even looked at it like that. But I would have said 5 years ago, maybe some gray market kit. But now with the size of the internet table bloat, you really can't use that old gear anymore. Right, it was never designed to hold tables this large, and not just, I mean, because it's not just the number of routes, right? So if an old 7600 Cisco router says that it can hold 750,000 routes, that's theoretically with stripped down NLRI, right? So the network layer reachability information that's accompanied it, like communities or how long the AS path is, that all that stuff eats RAM. So really, you don't get to hold that many routes. So it's sort of this weird guessing game when you're going to tip that processor over, which I've done multiple times to various pieces of hardware and then duct tape them back together before I ultimately replaced a lot of that infrastructure with, just like you said, ASR 9000s, and those things run like a top.
Yeah. Can imagine big x86 CPUs. They'll handle anything you throw at them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they are so bored holding multiple full tables, doing all kinds of filtering. I mean, they can't be bothered to even, you know, get off the couch. They're so bored. It's ridiculous.
Well, what I was getting at, though, is with MikroTik not really having any competition, like, a lot of people give MikroTik a hard time. But at the same time, I'm thinking, like, it's a $600 box, or it's a $3,000 box that's doing, can do almost 80 gigabits of throughput. What else can do that? I mean, they're not perfect, but for the price, they're pretty damn amazing.
Yeah. Where they fit in the space, it is such an amazing tool, and it gets better all the time. It's you're right. It's hard to argue with.
The other thing is that, say, you buy a Cisco ASR 920 or a Nokia 7210 or a Juniper ACX or any of those products, they're just a packet pusher. Like, they can't terminate services, so you can't run PPPoE server on them. You can't run a bunch of other layer 3 services on them. VRFs are pretty limited, whereas on a MikroTik you can do all those things and more. So for a wireless ISP, where you might have, say, 100 tower sites, you can run a PPPoE server at every one of those tower sites, and you can queue the traffic there. You can limit your customers to their 10 meg plan or their 100 meg plan. Do it all at the tower site closer to the customer, and you're going to get a much better backhaul performance on your network. There's going to be less traffic hairpin from one tower to the other, and it's just going to be a much better solution. So MikroTik have really nailed that. They've really understood the market there and delivered a good product.
Yeah, and there's been so many networks that I've helped folks with, or I've administered, where something goes wrong in the network and you've got to rig something temporarily. You could duct tape just about anything in a MikroTik router, even if you technically shouldn't, or you're just going to do it for a little bit. You know, it's amazing. How flexible these things can be to pull you out of a jam.
Definitely, like features like Torch and being able to packet capture in real time and stream packet captures with using TZSP into Wireshark, and all those features are really, really amazing. Nothing else really has them. This brings the other major downside of MikroTik, though, and when I was doing MikroTik consulting, I find this all the time. On a MikroTik, there's 10 ways to do any one task, and 9 of them are wrong. So the classic one I'd always get is customers would contact me and say they were having performance issues on their PPPoE server. You jump in there and they've got one little CCR1009 that's running everything. It's doing shaping, it's running PPPoE server, it's doing BGP routing, and they've never taken the time to understand what fast path is and how it works and how the packets flow through the router and how to get the best performance out of it. And you can massively optimize a MikroTix by understanding that, and it's not that hard to understand. So my advice to anyone that's starting to go down the MikroTix path at scale is to really understand how packets flow through the router and how technologies like FastPath work. I know, like on Junipers and that, they won't let you do anything that doesn't use FastPath. If it can't be done in FastPath, that's not even an option in the CLI. Whereas MikroTix will let you do stuff that traverses from fast path to slow path, and unless you know that's happening, you can really degrade the performance of the device.
That kind of reminds me of like switching, how they're getting a lot better about letting you know when hardware offloading is enabled and when it's disabled. I guess, you know, they now, like in the bridge interface, you see the H. If you see the H go away on your interfaces, I mean, you're probably feeling it performance wise, but at least it gives you some kind of indication of what's good. But you're right, all the features are there. Whether it's capable of doing it in the hardware or not is dependent on the product you happen to be using at the time. So it's not the same across
and how everything. It's configured.
Yeah, yeah. And that's it's always kind of been interesting to me that MikroTix. And right now I'm thinking about the CRS line because I just was doing some switching with these things. How they're doing industry standard things in very non-standard ways, like the way they configure things. You know, it's just, you're so used to the industry standard CLI version of, you know, put an access VLAN on this port, make it a trunk port. And it's just, they're so recalcitrant, you know, they're so obtuse when it comes to making things that flow the way every other vendor does it. But, and I'm sure Thomas right now is turning in his non-grave because he's not dead, but he just hasn't been here in like four times, so he feels dead to me. No, not really. Just kidding. But yeah. Like Thomas will always say, you know, just learn the interface and it's not a problem. I get it. But sometimes my brain just wants to do the same thing that I've done.
I think the interface they've got now using the bridge section is a lot better than it was previously. Like on the Qualcomm Atheros switches, you almost needed a PhD to drive the damn things and get the most out of them. They were absolutely horrific to configure. Like, as a bit of a tech nerd, I was like, wow, I can change everything. But then when I started to use them, I'm like, I have to change everything every single time. And it's so easy to miss one setting. Yeah. So they were really frustrating. Yeah. The new interface is much better, but you're right. It is not industry standard. It works completely differently from anything else. And they haven't really thought about the operation of the device. Like, there's no niceties in there. You can't easily select a range of ports. Now, I was getting really annoyed about not being able to select ranges within RouterOS and CLI or the or in Winbox. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute, I can use interface lists. Wait a minute, this is good. And I tried using it and it worked, but I could only use it for some things within the bridge interface. Not everything. You could only do half of the configuration using them. So I was like, what's the point? Like, you'd be better off to just be able to define ranges and everyone would be happy. But, I mean, MikroTix are new to this. They're reasonably new to the Marvell ASICs as well. So they're learning as they go. And if we don't complain, they won't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, what's funny is it's pretty close to having all the features. I mean, it's got all the features I require now. And I almost, there's only a couple of things where I have to go into the actual switch menu, you know, because it's, they've moved most everything to the bridge, which I think is great, right? A unified interface. You just do it in here, and if it could do hardware offload, it will. But there are still a couple of things you have to go to the switch menu for. And right off the top of my head, I can't remember if it's... I don't think it's DHCP snooping. Maybe it's... I can't remember what it is anymore. Like, I have them in my base configs, and I never think about it anymore. But there's a couple of things you have to go... Maybe it's unicast flooding or something, or... multicast flight? I can't remember. Anyway.
Surprise me. Yeah, there's a couple of things, like a couple of missteps I've made there, but they're going to work it out over time.
Oh, yeah.
One thing I have picked up on is, like, the back in the day, the smaller routers all had that little Qualcomm Atheros switch chip in them, so like the RV750GL, the Hex, PoE, all of those had that nice little Qualcomm chip. And for all its flaws in configuration, the capability of it was insane. Like, you had a 5-port switch, you could hardware rate limit ports on it. Now, the RB4011, even though it's a beast CPU-wise, you can't hardware rate limit a port. You have to set the port to 10 meg auto-negotiate or 100 meg auto-negotiate. That's as close as you can get to hardware rate limiting that port. And a lot of that functionality is gone, or it's not clear how it works now. And it's a real shame that they've done that. It's taken away that really powerful functionality that was in the smaller devices. They've moved to that Realtek chipset, which is fairly basic in comparison. I'm not sure why they did that. Maybe there's a supply chain issue, or could be anything, but it's not so great. It would be better if they could have stuck with the Qualcomm one and kind of integrated that within the new Switch control interface, to be honest. Just on those smaller products anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of supply chain issues, it makes me wonder how long it'll be before we see these 2004s hit the market. Because everything's like, I mean, I've been hearing people with huge delays, not just Microtik, you know, like on the HAP AC2s, I think we're going to see them like around August or something like that. The next, is that right, Mike? Something like that?
I think that's the date that I saw. Yeah, it was sometime in August was expected availability.
But I've heard it from all vendors at this point. Everybody's having delays. Expected, right? I mean, you know, when a whole country shuts down for a few months, I mean, it's got to be some blowback, right?
Yeah, a lot of people blame China, but to be honest, that's not the whole story. I mean, CCRs, the older CCRs were assembled, at least, in Lithuania. I think the PCBs and that were made there, and the cases were made in Germany or something like that anyway. But the thing is, where do the components come from? China. Like, doesn't matter where you assemble the product or do the final assembly, 95% of those components are going to come from China these days, no matter where you're buying them from. So it's going to be an issue.
For sure. Well, there was actually a couple of other products announced, right?
There was the HAP AC3.
I did have a couple things on that CCR. So about the BGP process in version 7, with a large number of peers, the more cores you have, the better.
Correct.
Is there any point, you know, whether it's practical or not, is there any point where a 1072 with 7 would be faster at BGP than this?
Sounds like a good test for you to do, Mike.
I think too, though, if you recall what Thrift was talking about, the way each peer kind of has its own rib, right? So each peer will have its own processor to work through. So theoretically, it shouldn't be as impactful now. So even with a fewer number of cores, it really shouldn't impact the device overall performance-wise as bad. So you might be all right.
Because, like, I have at least 3 routers that I've got access to that have over 50 BGP peers.
All right. Well, see, if that router reboots, you're boned, right?
At least 10 of those peers probably have over 25,000 routes.
Wow.
And so that is, you know... One's a CCR, the rest are x86, so I'm not worried about those. But it's just like, you know, if you're on a couple exchanges and you have bilateral sessions set up with everybody, you're going to have 50 to 100 BGP peers.
Yeah.
Yeah, 200,000-odd routes just off peering, generally.
But even then, if one or two peers reboot, you know, restart the session, you should still be all right. It's just if the whole thing goes down and comes back, that's going to be problematic.
I think with V7 routing, the CCR1000s are going to become much more usable, but it's not going to be the silver bullet. I mean, bigger cores are going to make all the difference, I suspect, here.
Sure, sure.
It also makes me wonder how long they're going to be able to support the old Tylera system, you know, that whole ecosystem, because... Right. As they advance and they put more time and energy into the ARM, which really is the future, right? You know, how much time and energy are they going to expend making sure that it still works with all that old CCR, Tylera stuff?
Yeah. I mean, at the time, the Tylera was the right decision to go with. I mean, it's a pretty cool architecture. Even when you look at it now, it's like, damn, that's real cool. The downside is that the company kind of got acquired, 3 times?
Yeah.
And just the support for it, because it wasn't ARM-based, it was completely proprietary. It's just really hard for them to support it. And yeah, Microtik have done an astounding job. Like,
yeah,
I hate to think about the amount of time the developers have put into making all of this work.
Yeah.
It's a pretty impressive feat, but yeah, ARM is definitely the future.
And that sounds like it was just bad luck, right? Nobody's crystal ball is perfect. They didn't know that what exactly future right. was
sure.
ahead of the Tylera stuff. So
my other thing on the CCRs here is that you had mentioned that this CPU only has about 50 gigs of, you know, backplane capacity.
That's right.
So then there are several rumored models. One of them even having 12 25 gig ports and two 100 gig ports.
That's right.
Are there other chips in that family that have a larger backplane?
It's really hard to know. Annapurna Labs are very secretive, not on purpose, just because they're part of Amazon and most of the chips are made for internal consumption. So why would they publish the data sheets and block diagrams? Because they're available on their intranet kind of thing. But Annapurna Labs do have two much larger processors. Now, that's not to say MicroTik are going to use them. There's plenty of other options out there that are ARM-based as well and from vendors that they already work with. The Annapurna Labs big boy processors are called the Graviton and the Graviton 2. Those power AWS instances today, and they do have significantly more connectivity on them. Now, as I said, MicroTik may have used those in the 2016. There is a 16-core version of the Graviton, or they could be using Marvell's Octeon TX or TX2 CPUs, which are pretty similar, but actually have much better connectivity than the Annapurna Labs Graviton CPUs. We don't know. Until they release the specs, we're just guessing.
Oh, yeah, because that 50 gig backplane limit would really suck if you're trying to route your two 100 gig ports.
Oh, yeah. That would be. But, I mean, in the 2004, this is for a particular use case. I think they looked at the 1009 and realized that even with those, people weren't even coming close to using the capacity of the box. They were just using it to terminate large numbers of connections or bilats inside a data center or an IX. The actual throughput of the device was pretty minimal. I mean, I know stacks of ISPs that got 1009s or 1016s connecting to IXs, and they'll run a dedicated cable over to Microsoft or Netflix, but the actual throughput on the device is still sub 10 gig kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think this decision here is a pretty good one. It keeps the cost low while still giving the number of 10 gig ports that most people are going to want. I also think it's extremely positive that they've gone to 25 gig interfaces instead of 40 gigs. I mean, 25 gig is the new 10 gig kind of thing. It's good. Takes a single wavelength. Brilliant as far as I'm concerned. So they've kind of kept up with the market trends here. The 2016 and future products, I mean, they're really exciting. Who knows what the architecture is going to be. Maybe they use a switch ASIC in front of the processor to offload layer 3, layer 4 processing. We don't know. That would be awesome, but who knows what MicroTik have got planned. I think until V7 routing's out, which will probably give us a few hints as to the direction that they're going, we're not going to know.
Sure. There's speculation that some of these potential CCR models have Wi-Fi. That would be interesting.
Yeah, so this is just the product IDs that I think Dunware from Hungary found inside the code. So the sure. CCR 2004 model, one of the ones that was in that list is the one that they have announced. So that does put some weight behind what he found. There were also, I think there were four models as at CCR 2004, and two of them had 60 gigahertz 802.11ay chips integrated into them. So those chips can do something like 20 gigabits of throughput over 60 gigahertz microwave links. Who knows what the future holds? So again, it's all speculation, Mike. Yeah.
Sure.
But that would mean, like, for example, those products, they could have this Annapurna Labs processor in them, have a 60 gigahertz link on one side and a 10 gig link on the other, or a 25 gig link on the other, and they could do 10 gigabits of throughput over a couple of hundred meters, and that would be a pretty amazing product. if they had two of those 60 gigahertz radios in there, it could actually form a 60 gigahertz mesh like the Facebook Telegraph network, and that would be very cool.
Was Microtech a Telegraph partner?
They are a member of that Telegraph working group or whatever it's called. Yeah, so who knows?
Maybe. You heard it here first?
We speculated it here first.
Oh, we made it up first.
There's a lot of possibilities there. So the other thing I'll say about the new CCR is hardware is nothing without software. So at the moment, we only have version 6 as a complete router OS. Version 7 is really MikroTik being dipping their toes in the water. It's come out. It's got very, very limited functionality. It's got a slightly newer kernel. Who knows, we might see another kernel bump to make the 2004 work. But it's missing routing, which is a pretty big feature of an operating system called router OS.
Yeah.
So until we get that, we just don't know what it's going to do. We don't know how it's going to perform. We've seen demonstrations of what it's capable of. But they could chuck a new kernel in there and add WireGuard support. It could add a whole bunch of different stuff, as well as the new routing engine. And so it's kind of at the point now they've released this new hardware. Surely the V7 routing is just around the corner now.
I think another thing towards that potentially is that in this new Winbox, there's also something was mentioned, like, you know, better large table support for version 7.
It's like, what they need large tables for, right?
Yeah, like, you know, what else? I mean, I guess you could have a large bridge table, but not hundreds of thousands of them, I would hope. So maybe this Winbox is preparing for that. That next, was it Beta 6 would be the next one?
The planets are aligning, right?
Yep. At which point we're going to get poked in the eye with a stick. All right, I think I'm done dominating the conversation.
What else do they talk about? There's a CRS-326 desktop switch coming out. Aren't you hyped for that?
Oh, yeah, a little bit. I don't know much about that one, mate. I was so impressed with the 2004. I gave that no attention.
Well, it looks like basically, the regular 326 shoved it to a desktop case instead of rack mount. So
okay, cool.
I didn't realize. Are people clamoring for a desktop size switch? I mean, maybe that would squeeze into like a box at a tower or something like that. Is that the idea? Maybe
could do. The other thing is, like, the markets that we're in are kind of the Western markets where we are used to rack mount stuff and doing things properly. A lot of the markets where MikroTik sell into are kind of third world countries, where they'll just buy whatever they can, slam it on the top of a desk, and she'll be right. So, I mean, those products might be far more suitable.
As long as the bits are flowing.
Not in, yeah, I mean, back in the day, we used to do the same thing, right?
Who says we don't still? Okay.
Yeah. The amount of switches I've found screwed to the ceiling, like inside a roof cavity and things like that. Yeah, people still do that.
There's a guy help with his network, and he ended up with a layer 2 loop. This was about a month ago, inside of his network, and it's all Netonic switches. And for the life of me, I couldn't track it down. Just their spanning tree is apparently just trash inside of Netonic stuff, and there was no insight. I couldn't figure it out. I was just like, so we had been planning on moving to routed forever, and you know, he was just. Too many things going on, he couldn't get to it. Well, guess what we did in a day and a half's time? We moved that Joker to routed. And then one of his boxes, I don't remember which router it was. I think it was one of the 1100 AHX4s he had. And, you know, we got that one configured because we ended up rolling like 4 or 5 towers. And so we got that one configured, got it plugged in. Everything was working. And he took a picture and he goes, he had it kind of cocked inside the box, like sort of halfway in. It was hanging out, and he couldn't put the lid on. He's like, yeah, but it doesn't fit. And then 5 minutes later, he sends me a picture, and he took the cover off of it, and it just squeezed in. He goes, it fits now. So it's just the naked board sitting in there with the lid screwed on. Oh, it's brilliant. I love it.
Wireless ISPs are different though, Greg. I mean, you're at the top of a mountain, it's raining, you got the quad bike covered in mud, you just make it work, who cares?
Well, we were just in the early stages of the corona lockdown, the fever pitch, where everybody was just, you know, learning how to work from home and all that stuff, and then he's got this layer two loop in his network and just everything's going bananas. No. So it was like we had to get it done no matter what.
Yeah.
And it ended up going far better than it should have, but it cracked me up, you know. Yeah, so it's probably still shoehorned. I don't think he's got a chance to replace it yet, so it's just running like a chicken with his head cut off with this half-assembled board in there. But yeah, I mean, I could see somebody, oh, I got a box, a full rack mount, so I can fit in there. I'll shove this giant, you know, squeeze this Joker in there, and we'll call it a day. Move on to the other parts that are on fire. So I definitely see that. And I've been enjoying the 300 series switches. I finally got some of those up and going, and once you get over the kind of the audit, oh man, I had an installer put them out, and he started arbitrary. I had everything configured for SFP port 1 on all the switches, and he started arbitrarily like putting SFP 1 or the next IDF, he did like SFP 2, and it was like, for the life of me, I can't figure out why the switch won't come up. And then it took me forever to realize, oh, he put it in the wrong port. And then you reconfigure that, and then I forget that there's some stuff in the switch menu. I was like, ah, crap. All right. Now, why can't I ping this thing? Oh, yeah. Okay, let's see. Okay, yeah. And then, yeah, it's just interesting little squirrels that kind of run around in there. Well, while we're speculating, and you're a speculating man, what would you, if you had your druthers and you had this ARM-based CPU or any other one, what's the ideal piece of hardware you'd like to see come out of MikroTik?
You mean for the big boy router?
For anything. For anything.
I don't know. There's so many products they could make. Like, there's a lot of untapped markets that they haven't gone into. So they've never really built a proper WISP switch. They've never built something that will output multiple different voltages.
Right.
And you can select per port what voltage you want to output. That market was really originally Ubiquiti had their edge switch, I think it was. What was that thing, that brick, the 8-port brick thing that you could shove in a cabinet? They were AC only originally, passively cooled. So Ubiquiti had that.
Tough switch?
That's the one. Yeah, those were pretty good.
Except it wasn't very tough.
Yeah, they used to crash a lot. But they were, I mean, the hardware, physical hardware, was pretty cool. The guys over at Nutonix came out with their products, and they really nailed it. Like, they understood what wireless ISPs wanted. I mean, there's a few quirks. The user interface on them is horrific. Like, it's really bad.
Yeah.
You have to really understand how you can bone yourself with those things. Otherwise, you will. Particularly doing things like lags and stuff like that on them. They're
a little tricky.
Quite hard. Yeah, real tricky. But they nailed it. They nailed the multiple voltages,
yep,
multiple power supplies, boost buck converters, all that stuff. Like, MikroTik could do this with their eyes closed.
Yeah.
Why haven't they done it? Like, they could use those Marvell Prestera chipsets, particularly the 3336, I think it is. It's got layer 3 forwarding and hardware. It can do wire speed layer 3 on a chip that's like a couple of bucks bill of materials cost. They could use that. They could put a couple of boost buck converters in there to provide different voltages out and in,
yeah,
to the device. And they could do layer 3 routing at wire speed in a tower router in a single 1AU box. And they'd just decimate the marketplace with that
thing.
And
I bet they could make it to where you could unplug a live PoE power device and it doesn't fry the switch port. I bet you they could do that.
Oh, yeah, they get that stuff right too.
I bet you they could crack that enigma.
I mean, the other thing is, it's pretty simple hardware-wise, and they've got proven capability to build high-quality power supply circuitry. Like, you look at the RB1100AH and the old RB800s, the power supply circuitry on those, they were a work of art, both of those products. They just need to develop something with a couple of boost buck converters on it to deliver at least two, if not three, available voltages on a bus, on three buses, and just use each port to be able to select from one of those buses with some soft relays or whatever you want to put in there, so that if, say, that the switch is being supplied with 24 volts, they buck it down to 12, mm-hmm, or leave it at 24 and boost it up to 48. That means you can power a like a Seragon microwave link off of it, or a Ceph Technica at negative 48 volts out the PoE ports while you still run your Ubiquiti links or your Cambium EPMPs at 24 volts. I mean, they can do all that stuff, so why don't they?
Yeah, it'd be a bananas.
It's probably $10 or $20 million of extra revenue each year, if not more. I don't know.
And also the idea of that you basically said you could do the layer 3 forwarding and be able to handle it. So instead of having a switch and, well, I mean, some people are even going PoE injector, switch, router, instead of having all those three separate pieces, you have it in one box. So one, your configurations, your installations, they're all simpler. Stocking equipment is simpler. It just seems so much cleaner and simpler. I love the idea of that.
It does. Yeah, and the thing is, maybe they're waiting for V7, where they've got a separate fib and rib to be able to do that, because obviously you'd need to program the fib inside the switch chip. But it just seems so obvious. Hopefully they go down that kind of avenue. It would be really good for the WISP industry, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And good for their bottom line.
And so then the royalty checks for that idea go to Andrew Thrift at 123 Main Street, Brisbane, Australia.
Well, I mean, too, just think about all of the functionality that you have built within RouterOS. So now your switch can intelligently monitor each radio that hangs off of its interface. And if it quits responding, I mean, you can write a script that will then reboot that link for you, right? So it kind of...
That's right.
I mean, one, having controllable PoE remotely is going to save you truck rolls. But two, if it can do it on its own and you don't, I mean, and it just sends you an alert and says, hey, I did this thing, how much better is your life going to get after something like that?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah, definitely. As far as the like big CCRs, I mean, there's lots of things I'd like to see MikroTik do, but I've got to remember they're really targeted at that small to medium size ISP. Yeah. I can't expect them to go and build a MX204 grade router or a ASR 9010 grade router. I mean, those are pipe dreams. But if they can deliver something that provides great performance and value to those small and mid-sized ISPs while continuing that flexibility that they've always had, I think they're going to be onto a winner there. The big ones are obviously that are important now, 100 gig interfaces and 100 gig forwarding performance, and just the routing engine stuff as well. So
it just
they can do that.
It seems so incongruous to talk about, you know, they're not trying to chase, you know, like you were saying, like the giant chassis-based vendors, but now we're talking about 100 gig interfaces. It's kind of seems like, you know, I mean, it's like, I don't know a whole lot of ISPs that require 100 gig interfaces. Actually, I know very few. So if you're going to put that kind of firepower on your router, I mean, isn't that sort of the market you're chasing?
The thing is, people see MikroTik as only being inside ISPs and wireless ISPs, but when you go through any of the data centers in Australia or New Zealand at least, you see MikroTik's everywhere, particularly in like hosting, like VPS providers and web hosting providers and that. They'll often have a couple of MikroTik's per rack doing various functions. So it's not just ISPs and WISPs that are using them. I know at the place I previously used to work, our internet connectivity might have been a couple of gigabits, but we had multiple 10 gigabit rings between all of our data centers, and they're looking at going to 100 gig now, and they need to route that somehow. Like they're now using Juniper, but if a MikroTik product had existed and been stable at those speeds, we would have used it. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just... More the ASR 9000s, they have like very large numbers of 100 gig interfaces, and you can run various TDM type interfaces on them, and they've got very resilient hardware platforms because they're chassis based. That's the area I don't really see MikroTik kind of going into that area. It's more the single box kind of high speed performance thing.
So if you're in an average Australian or New Zealand data center, how many customers do you think would be utilizing MikroTik percentage wise? You think like 25%?
Oh, far more than that. It'd be in New Zealand at least, it would be 60-70% of all ISPs that are in. There's a particular data center called The Data Center at 220 Queen Street in Auckland. If you walk through there, almost every rack has got a MikroTik or multiple MikroTiks. Now, they might not be using it for their service provider routing. A lot of them will use it for VPNs for out of band, or they might be terminating L2TP or PPPoE connections on them. but they're just ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And in Australia, I don't see as many, but I still see quite a lot. I'd say probably 30 to 40% of racks here seem to have a Micritic in them. Yep, yep. Just walking through NextDC and various other data centers, they're also everywhere, but just not as much as New Zealand.
Yeah, that's like...
And I think the...
Go ahead.
I think the reason for that is Kiwis in particular like to do a lot of things with one box. They like to get maximum value. I know previously when I worked for Fortinet, back in the early 2000s, this was a big frustration for us, as people would buy a box and literally turn on all the features. and when it didn't work, they'd get real angry. Yet the American guys didn't understand that this was going to happen. They thought, well, if you want to do firewalling, you buy a box for that. If you want to do routing, you buy another box for that. But not Kiwis. No, they buy one box and turn it all on. And it's the same with Micritic. A Micritic can do a lot of functions. Like, it can be a PPPoE server as well as your BGP router. It can do all those things. So I think it really fits that market quite well. I know they're very, very popular in South Africa too. So a lot of South Africans will move to Australia and New Zealand, and you get talking to them and they're all very familiar with Micritics. Yeah. So they're just, I don't know how popular they are in the States. I've got no visibility of that really.
Like in most of the data centers I've been in, you'll see a couple of boxes here and there, maybe, but not very many. Most of our data centers aren't really comprised of ISPs. You know, it's usually business, enterprise, stuff like that. And very few of those guys, you see it. Having said that, I helped some folks that were putting in a big, massive fiber ring. I mean, it's all Ciena kit with 100 gig. It's a big 100 gig ring going a couple of different directions. And the box I stuck in there to be their kind of their administrative firewall and VPN is a Micritic HAPAC2, and it works great. You're sitting next to, you know, $1 million Ciena build right next to it, but quite literally sitting on top of it. But you know, it's neither here nor there. It serves its purpose. It just cracks me up how that works. And you know, it's so funny. There's so many people that just haven't been introduced to it. I started, as I would give tours, if I had a network engineer that was on my tour, I would start talking to him about Micritic stuff, you know, and most of them had never heard of it. And so I started keeping a whole like stack of Haplites in my desk, and I would go and get a Haplite and give it to him. And then you know, I mean, it's an $18-19 piece of kit, and I ended up doing that with a managed service provider. And I think somewhere around 6 months later, I ran into the guy again, and he was like, "Yeah, I gave one to every one of my techs. We're starting to roll them out in different places." So it's funny. It started catching on a little bit, but you just don't see it as pervasively here. I'm not sure. Maybe just the Cisco's, Junipers, Fortinet's here just have such a foothold that, you know, there's no room for the Micritic stuff. I don't know. I mean, I'm not really sure. What do you think, Mike?
I mean, I see more MX960s than I see Micritics, period, in the big data centers.
Interesting.
I mean, you know, you've got enormous chassis, crazy expensive, and, you know, I'll see fewer Micritics than I will of those. You know, but then I guess it's kind of a surprise. It's like, oh, this guy has a Micritic. Like, it's more exciting that, you know, when you see one that does than if, oh, well, you know, everybody's got one, so
he's,
you know,
one whatever. Of us.
I think one of the other things in New Zealand that really cemented them there, I mean, it's a small market, close to 5 million people, but the distributor there in the early days went to NZNOG, which is a big ISP conference. And they sponsored it and gave every single attendee, I think it was like a HAP AC light or whatever it was. So every single person got one of those. So they got it for free and they became familiar with them. And I think they realized how powerful they were and that they're a bit of a Swiss Army knife. And that's why you see them in racks doing out-of-band management, VPNs and that, because they're cheap and they work. And while they might not be doing their core routing, they're providing some value and some functionality to them.
Yeah. I know.
I was thinking, like, there's probably fewer of those really big routers in New Zealand because there's just not that much internet there.
Yes and no. So a lot of providers are running really big MXs for their border routing and call routing, as well as Nokias and Ciscos, depending on the ISP. The connectivity in New Zealand is actually surprisingly large, and the reason for that is that they put out a tender a few years ago, the government did, where they'd 50% fund the rollout of a fibre network. So fibre to the home is ubiquitous in New Zealand. You can get a 4 gigabit and connection in most towns in New Zealand now to your house for $130 a month kind of thing. So the amount of connectivity is fairly big. The backbones of those things are running massive Nokia 7950 XRSs, and the amount of bandwidth is just phenomenal. So ISPs there are handling quite large volumes of traffic. Even in Australia, I've worked with quite a few ISPs here, and the volumes of traffic here are significantly lower than the ISPs in New Zealand. In the same segment anyway, as a small ISP, they seem to be with the same number of customers, the volume of traffic is lower because the last mile connectivity here is smaller. Like, most people here have got a 20 meg connection or 100 meg connection at the very most at home, whereas in New Zealand everybody has a gigabit connection. So that's the difference.
I suppose also some of the difference is that most of the data centers I spend my time in are, it's 350 Cermak in Chicago. It's, you know, it's the largest, data center in the world.
You expect to see big Junipers and Ciscos in there and not little MikroTiks kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where just to get to your rack, it takes you a half hour of walking.
Back to what Greg was saying before, there were some other products like the CRS-326 desktop switch, as well as the HAP AC3. That's another interesting product. It looks to be the HAP AC2 in a fat boy kind of form factor, and it's got LTE 12 built into it, Cat 12 LTE. So I'm guessing they manufactured that for a specific customer or a specific market. It looks pretty funky.
Aren't they doing the Latvian Telecom partnership thing?
LMT.
I
wonder if we'll see a version that does not have LTE, because the first one they came out with was the LTE version. Yeah. And in the model number, it's like blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like 30 characters long. Plus, you know, RT11E, or, you know, I don't remember the model number, but, you know, plus LTE module.
But without LTE, it's just a half AC2, mate.
Yeah.
It's the same hardware.
I was going to say, there's no sense in having the form factor so enormous.
Oh, it's just...
Yeah.
So then, why would they call it the AC3 if it's the same thing as the AC2? Yeah,
that's right. When I saw the AC3, I was expecting it to have a bump up to the newer Qualcomm 8000 or 6000 series. But when it had the same 4000, I was like, this is odd. I mean, yeah, it's very strange.
Interesting.
Yeah,
so, all right.
Cool product, but seems very market specific.
But I have noticed that they've gotten a lot better at their LTE band support. At the beginning, I couldn't understand the bands that they chose, and now they support most of them. All the ones I complained about for years are now supported.
Yeah, I think obviously, every region has different bands. I know over in Asia, Southeast Asia, bands 3 and 7 are absolutely the most common. And then individual countries might have odd bands to cover 700 megahertz. Like in Australia and New Zealand, we use band 28. And I think Southeast Asia uses a lot of band 41. I don't know what the States uses, but I think they're a completely different set of bands again. And that's what makes it a challenge to get that support.
it was for the PCS bands, you know, the 1.9 gigahertz area. I don't remember what the smaller band was, but, you know, there's a subset band that they supported. The superset band that was band 25, they didn't. And, you know, my carrier of choice used band 25. So it was like, why? Like, you already support those frequencies, just support the one right next to it. And now they have, and they've got, I think two, two times carrier aggregation that works across bands, all depending on the bands you're trying to use. So that's nice.
That is nice. It'll be interesting to see how they perform, actually.
Interesting. All right, so we're getting pretty deep in, but I still wanted to ask you, Andrew, what are you doing for your pressure relief for all of the quarantine? I mean, you guys are still locked down pretty tight there, right?
Yeah, yes and no. We're not locked down that tight, so a lot of stores are still open. So I guess hardware stores are still open. You can still go to restaurants that are takeaway only. You can still go to a cafe and grab coffee as long as it's takeaway. It's okay. It doesn't bother. Those things don't bother me too much, to be honest. The world still keeps turning. I'm still alive. I just look after the ones that are close to me and do what I can, kind of thing, to limit the spread. I'm not going out there and holding hands with people, doing customer meetings.
How's how are your wife and kids sort of adjusting to the mostly staying at home scenario?
They're pretty good. Like, both my wife and I are working from home, and we're having to homeschool the kids at the moment. But the schools here, the state education system's been pretty organized. They're using OneNote and Zoom and a bunch of different other technologies to keep in touch with the kids. And it's been pretty good. The other thing is, in a classroom, like, there might be 20 other kids in there. The teacher only gets a small amount of time to spend with each kid. So they might only get 2 hours a day out of the 8 hours or whatever that they're there of teacher time. Whereas now that they're home, we're actually giving them a lot more time than that. So it's really helping with their education, and we've got the material provided to us. Each day I'm taking my kids out for a bike ride as well, just to let them blow off some steam so they don't end up fighting with each other and winding us up. And that seems to be working out pretty well. So we're still able to go out and do exercise. You're just not allowed to gather in large groups in public areas. So, yeah. But our numbers are going down. I mean, there's still new cases every day, but it's not like it was 3 weeks ago where it was getting pretty scary there for a while.
Yeah. Well, we're definitely still on the rise. You know, us Americans are overachievers, so just got to show the rest of the world how it's done. Oh, man. Something new that I've been doing is, I don't know, man, ever since I switched jobs over to Red Hat, I felt so much more creative. I don't know, man. I guess I just had been in such a rut beforehand that, to be honest with you, I am like more productive and creative now than I have been in forever. And it's just, it's the strangest of times for all that stuff. But I came up with a concept called Operation Shock. And it's this right here. I'll show it to you.
You're electrocuting yourself?
I mean, it's for the amusement of others. You know, it's not just me. So you remember the classic board game Operation? I've upgraded it so that now there's an Arduino that monitors the voltage on this guy. And whenever you buzz, you know, you like touch the side, it goes through a relay to a TENS unit and it shocks the hell out of you. But it only shocks you for 200 milliseconds. So what I did is, when I was in the shower this morning, I was thinking about it. We haven't actually played it yet. I've just rigged it up. So I came up with the idea of a progressive mode. So I put a little switch on it. When you switch it to progressive mode, every time you hit the buzzer, it adds an extra 200 milliseconds. So the idea being is it exponentially grows. Every time you buzz, it's going to zap you longer and longer. So I was thinking of two things. We're going to do speed runs. We're probably going to do it tonight. I'm going to record it. It's going to be amazing. We're going to do speed runs where you have to get all the pieces out and it's just you, right? So maybe, I don't know who I'm going to be able to convince to do progressive mode. I think I'm going to go for it just because I will be very careful for obvious reasons. But I was thinking too, that would be really fun to play progressive mode just in a regular game. So it's just, it really, I don't know, man. If you really light it up, the next guy's going to be super mad at you. And you'll just, I'm feeling that everybody will be very careful. So I can't wait to get that one going. That was a quick hack.
Great idea.
But I can't wait to play that. I've threatened to mail it to other people once we get done playing, because I know we're going to play once and I'm not going to be able to convince them to play again. So that one's going to be done when we're done with it. How about you, Mikey? What are you guys doing right now?
Well, I already worked from home, and Kate still works at her place because it's a retirement community. So, you know, old people still need that. Actually, there's more work to do there now because they're not allowed to go get their own groceries or, you know, they're not allowed to go out and do all those things. So now staff has to do it for them.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of coordination that has to happen. And so same thing here.
Yeah. Here in the South, I think Georgia and Texas are opening. I think Georgia's opening up big time on Monday. Like pretty much they're going ham. I think they're going to open like barbers and, you know, like hair salons. I think I heard restaurants, they're going to allow people to go in and sit down. They're just going to like require spacing in between people. Here in Texas, I think they're starting to open up a ton of regular old businesses again. So we'll see how that goes.
It's well,
even
like,
if we were, even if we were able to go out, I still wouldn't.
No, I'm not.
I didn't have to.
No, I mean, that's what I was saying. Like I'm perfectly fine. I could, foreseeable future, Red Hat's not going to have me traveling. At some point they will. But I have a feeling it's going to be way in the distant future. And so I don't actually have to go anywhere. And so I'm going to do my part and just stay here, I guess. Oh, gyms. Yeah. Atlanta's opening gyms again. And I think Texas is getting ready to open gyms as well. So, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. One thing that like I couldn't, like, around here for the longest time, like, starting May 1st, they're going to loosen some things while make other things more strict. But, like, what I hadn't understood is, like, okay, so the, you know, each business has an occupancy permit for a certain number of people based on a variety of different things. Why can't the state just say, okay, you know, we are going to slash your occupancy permit by 10. Mm. You know, you can only allowed to have 1/10 of the people you would normally have in your business. See how that goes. If you don't want to open because there's not enough people for you, then fine. But like, you know, the spacing provided by having 1/10 fewer people or a half or, you know, whatever, you know, why haven't they tried that?
That's effectively what they have here. So I went to the hardware store the other day and there was a massive queuing system set up outside. And you had to basically wait. They'd only allow X number of people into the store at a time. And they had people standing at the end of every aisle to make sure there were only 4 people in each aisle so that you were forced to be socially distanced in that case. And I mean, it was good. I could still go and get my pot plants and various other bits and pieces. And I felt reasonably safe in there. Yeah.
You grab so a sausage I think there can the be.
They didn't have it, mate. They weren't operating that. That's still shut down.
Why'd you even bother
Why
going?
Why did I go? Exactly right. But, yeah, so you still get access to the services. It's just pretty heavily restricted. Yeah. Hairdressers and things like that are still closed here, though. So,
yeah.
On the first, they're going to open up pet grooming services, but not people grooming services. Oh, okay.
Not a big
deal. It's a bit scary, though. Like, hundreds of thousands of people have lost their jobs. I think where the true unemployment rate's at 16%. So the government's kind of fudged things pretty heavily here. They've introduced something called the JobKeeper allowance, where they pay the employer to keep you employed. So instead of giving you a direct payout, they pay your employer to make it look like you are employed so that the unemployment statistics are kept quite low. So I mean, in one way it's good, but the cynic in me says that a lot of it's just a political play to make the numbers look better than they really are. But things are certainly getting pretty bad from the unemployment front, and I really hope that people realize that even if they lose their job, that life does go on.
Absolutely.
There is going to be a bounce back and things are going to keep going. Just might take a little while and everyone's in the same boat as they are.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I've got a friend over here that just recently lost his job due to the to the COVID stuff and cut back to their company. But do you think maybe over there in Australia, and maybe this was just isolated for me, but when I went over there for Andrew's wedding, they stuck me with Tessa's parents who didn't know me from Adam. And they took me in like I was flesh and blood. And then after a week, I had to move across the street to just their friends. These people didn't know me. And they just took me into their house, you know. And I feel like culturally, Australia is probably a little bit different. And I feel like maybe you guys will kind of pull together as a community and kind of just, you know, pitch in and kind of pick those people up and help, you know, take care of your community. Yeah. Whereas here, we feel more isolated. I don't know.
Australia is very community focused. Like, we get flyers in the mailbox every day, people offering help and assistance and that, and if you can't go and get your groceries, mainly to help older people. So Aussie really is, as I said, community focused, and we do band together to kind of get through the hard times, because there is a history of hard times in Australia. I mean, we haven't had a recession for over 20 years, but prior to that, they had regular financial wobbles, and I mean, it's a hard country to live in. If you're in the main cities, it's not too bad, but in the rural areas and southwest Queensland and those sort of places, life is hard. So people are used to banding together, which is a good thing.
Absolutely.
Even before that, you know, it was a prison. So, you know, you're banding so together against the guards.
I don't know. I think America sort of has this this feeling of every person should pull themselves up by their bootstraps, right? So they should, I mean, if you need to get yourself out of a situation, just work harder, you know? And I think sometimes that kind of, I don't know, taints the way people view others, right? Like, if you're not able to take care of yourself, there's something wrong with you, and it's not my job to help you out. And whenever I went over to Australia, it was just, it felt so different, and I loved it. Like, it was an amazing atmosphere and environment.
There's a bit of a combination here. Like, people here are quite against social welfare and those sort of things. But if you're down on your luck, they'll help you out and give you a chance. But if you mess up, they will definitely not give you a second chance. Can be pretty ruthless in that regard. Yeah. That was a big thing I noticed, is the difference between Australia and New Zealand. In New Zealand, that there's a lot more social welfare and acceptance of those sort of things. Hmm. Whereas over here, there's not as much of an acceptance, but people are more willing to help you.
It's interesting. So I don't know if culturally, I'm sure culturally it's different for you guys, but I wonder how much that factors in for Americans here. Like, you know, just with the stress of all this stuff and the, you know, theoretical, what happens if I lose my job here, there? Like, a friend of mine lost his job, and he actually posted in the Slack, if anybody's looking for assistance, he's trying to get anything, but he's in the process of buying a house right now. And so, building a house. And when the house gets done, then he has to show his pay stubs to get his mortgage. And so it's like, he's in this mad scramble right now, because he's got to have, even if he picks up a job at McDonald's, he just needs 4 pay stubs, you know, in a row to make this happen. So, I can totally get that.
And then, you know, I had a useful suggestion for him.
What was that?
Knowing the area in which he lives, where he previously worked, I was like, hey, I hear there's an opening.
Mike told him to go get my old job.
Over here, there's like, because of the supermarkets and grocery stores and hardware stores have been so busy, there's been such an influx. There's plenty of jobs going at those places. I'm not sure what it's like over in the States. I'm assuming that the grocery stores are absolutely flat tack as well, and they're wanting employees. Yeah. And sure, it might not be the most glorious work, but it's work.
Absolutely.
Yet, at the same time, there's a lot of healthcare systems laying people off because there's nothing to do. They've been banned from doing elective operations.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's about to pick
back up. But there's nobody coming
in. Monday, they're changing. That's one of the things too, elective surgeries. Like, a sister-in-law of mine is an x-ray tech, and she mostly works in sports medicine. So, that's not doing anything for them right now, but they're opening it up basically to anything x-ray style. But again, they've been, I mean, really nothing going on. because surgeries and all that stuff stuff. And if everybody's not out there playing sports and, you know, knocking heads, they're not breaking bones. So
yeah,
their business kind of waned. Oh, I also have a friend in Galveston that was a dentist. And so that's crazy. He's been a dentist for like 25 years and now, you know, he's out of a job. That's crazy.
That's crazy. I mean, I haven't seen anything like this in my lifetime. I mean, the GFC hit us pretty bad in New Zealand when I was living there. But even then, it was not like this. People, dentists in particular, kept their jobs.
Yeah.
Medical people kept their jobs. But other industries like building and construction and that, they were annihilated. Whereas now, it seems like no industry is really immune to this.
Yeah. Well, the time is now. IT people have all the power.
Exactly.
We are the glue holding the world together at the moment. One Zoom conference at a time.
Nerds will now rule the world.
We always did, didn't we? I thought it was that way.
Well, yeah, but nobody knew it. You know, now they know it because we're the only ones working.
Less secretly. Now it's more public.
I'm really interested to see how many industries kind of claw things back into their own countries. Like, obviously, the United States saw a lot of manufacturing move over to China and a lot of call centers move over to the Philippines and various other countries, and so did we in Australia. A lot of medical supplies in that, though, I suspect they're going to start pulling those back to be manufactured locally within region. Particularly, I think, obviously, a lot of electronics and stuff are going to be manufactured in China and Vietnam and India and those sort of places, just due to ease of supply chain. But I'm really interested to see what happens in the next 5 to 10 years. I think there's going to be some really major changes.
Yeah, I was thinking definitely diversification of supply chain, right? It's just instead of, you know, just one place, you're going to try and draw from as many. I wonder if the government's going to do some subsidies to help kind of pull some of that manufacturing back, right? Because as long as it's more financially viable to do it elsewhere, most people do it, right?
You know, I got the idea, and I won't go too far off of this, but like, there's a couple big political concerns that the United States has. You know, one of them involves China. You know, one of them involves illegal immigrants. Legal immigrants mostly is because due to lack of economic opportunity where they came from. Well, if you buy all your crap from China and you don't like China, incentivize people to move their manufacturing from China to the countries that you have a major illegal immigration problem from. Now you weaken China, who you're concerned with, but now you incentivize people to stay in the country they came from, and now you have a diversified supply chain.
On the surface, you know, it sounds good, Mike, but these things are always a lot more complicated than that.
Well, sure. I mean, yeah, but it's like, you know, but this, I think, is going to require some of that. Like, you know, we're going to diversify our supply chains. Okay, you know, how do we make this happen? Obviously, that was in the details. And for all I know, everything could stay exactly the same because China is cheap. But, you know, I mean, at the same time, you know,
you got to look at it. Why did manufacturing move to China? It was companies wanting to battle taxes and unions and things like that traditionally. And they can't get manufacturing to move back unless they solve those problems, as well as the fact that the entire supply chain is now in China. Like, it's so hard. You couldn't manufacture a lot of electronics in the United States or Europe anymore because all the components come from China. So the cost of production and the delays to production are just going to be phenomenal. Like, the boat has sailed. It's going to take 10 plus years to get that stuff back.
You know, something else heard is there's the only other pinball manufacturing company outside of the U.S. is a guy from Australia, and he does all his manufacturing in China. And he says that he primarily does it in China because they have the most and best skilled labor over there for any kind of electronics work, any kind of repetitive manufacturing, right? So they've built so much capital, you know, as far as people and knowledge and practice goes, that really he's basically said there's an incredible amount of talented people and we could never exhaust. So anything you know, if we wanted to ramp up 20 times our size, we could do that overnight just because there is so much talent there.
Oh, definitely. And the thing is, though, a lot of that's to do with trade training and skill training that used to exist when I was younger, and it doesn't exist at all now inside Western countries that I've been to, at least. Like, they just lost it. So back in the 80s and in the 19s, or probably from the 1950s onwards, the major telecommunications company in New Zealand used to take on effectively apprentices straight out of high school, and they would train them up on low-level electronics as well as like field technician type stuff. And those guys are still in the industry now, still doing like hardcore microwave stuff and electronic systems and networking and that. And they were all trained up by these organizations. Now, if you want to train up on that, you have to do it yourself.
Right.
You don't get a helping hand, and a lot of those skills are gone. Likewise with automotive engineering and design and manufacturing. Australia's just in the last year, well, a few years ago now, closed their last automotive manufacturer here. And on the surface, it looks like a good decision because they were making cars that were, I guess, unwanted by modern society. They were making like four-door saloons and things rather than the popular SUVs and small cars. And that manufacturing left Australia, but what they didn't realize is all of those skills are gone as well. Mm. Like, while they're still here now and they're still working in other industries and manufacturing water filtration systems and things like that, they were training up tens of thousands of people every few years, and that's not happening anymore. Where is that training coming from? It's gone. And that's the same problem that's happening in a lot of other countries, and it's why China has had that advantage, because they've been doing it and we haven't. So it's a pretty complicated subject, but
absolutely.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I just wish my kids would be interested in anything that I find remotely interesting. At this point, it's all Fortnite or some kind of weird Minecraft first person shooter derivative. I don't know. My kids are always trying to talk about some weird stuff, and it's just like, I can't make myself care. I pretend to care, but I can't make myself care with that stuff.
I get the daily rundown on Roblox.
Yeah.
I understand, Greg.
Yeah. But, you know, I was talking to my wife today. I was like, you know, how are we going to teach our kids to have any ambition and any motivation to go and do things and find and blah? And she goes, nobody trained you on that. You just figured it out. I was like, oh. Yeah, I guess exactly, you got a point there. It's like, maybe I should stop worrying about it so much. You know, they're going to find what they're interested in, and hopefully they'll be passionate enough to really chase it down, whatever it happens to be.
Kids find their own way. I know a lot of my ambition came from people telling me I couldn't do things. It's like, damn you, I'm going to prove you wrong.
I know that's one of the surest ways to get my kid to my oldest, especially. I don't know why he's got this... the streak where he needs to compete with his old man. Like if I challenge him to something, yeah, then he's going to get it done. Otherwise it's impossible. It's ridiculous. Kids are the worst and the best simultaneously. All right. We are at 140. Are you guys have any other final thoughts that are, of pressing importance?
I didn't want to make a quick comment on something I've been battling with today as a warning to people. Just because you have set up fail to ban on a server does not mean that fail to ban is working on your server. apparently, the server I set it up on is using the APF firewall, while fail to ban was set up to use IP tables. So I would check the IP tables listings. Oh, yep, all the rules are in there. But they didn't do anything because IP tables wasn't even turned on. So that's been challenge. Because that server was sitting at like 100% CPU and 100% RAM forever, and I couldn't figure out why. Well, it's because the firewall is not actually blocking anything. Because it's not hammered the whole time. Because the wrong one's turned on.
Awesome.
I actually, that reminds me. I think it would be really good to do a cast that goes heavily into kind of Linux networking technologies. A lot of people in the ISP and WISP industry are using Linux. And when I was doing consulting, I'd jump onto a bunch of Linux servers and find all sorts of crazy firewall schemes and people using connection tracking on web servers and all sorts of things. And they were always having issues with it. And I think it would be really cool to do a podcast on that. There's also a bunch of really cool stuff that's happening right now in the Linux kernel to do with networking. So there's new technologies called XDP, as well as BPF, which are being introduced. Well, they've been in the kernel for a while, but they're actually becoming useful now. They allow you to do a kernel bypass and accelerate networking functionality and do things like firewall filtering between the NIC and the kernel, which means it's going to be a lot faster.
Interesting.
So where that's used is Cloudflare and Facebook use it on all of their servers today to stop denial of services before it hits the kernel. So you can use it for all sorts of things, including packet forwarding, but I think it would be really cool to do a cast on that.
All you have to do is tell us when, Andrew, and we will schedule it. Anytime you want to do anything where you talk intelligently about anything, if you want to talk about what you ate for breakfast, you just let us know and we will schedule this thing. That is the feedback I always get is, when can we get more of that beautiful hair on the podcast? Oh. And I'm like, I don't know, man. It's like he's almost like version 7. It's like, is he ever going to arrive? I don't know. And then magically he appears.
Hey, I'll come on as much as I can, mate. But yeah, I think it would be really cool to do that. I'll tee it up with Thomas. I think Thomas has probably got some pretty good opinions on it as well.
Opinions, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. He's got some thoughts, I'm sure. I'm sure he's got a couple of manifestos written about it. All right. So Andrew Thrift, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they go about that?
Best ways nowadays are to hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm on there under my name, Andrew Thrift, or you can find me on Facebook as well. I'm in all of the Wireless ISP groups, as well as on microtik-routeros.com. We've got a Facebook page there where we publish new products and talk about scripts and various other things that you can do on Microtik. So go onto one of those places and you'll find me there.
Fantastic. Mikey, how do people get a hold of you?
Patreon.com/thebrotherswisp because I am busy as hell, and if you go there, I know someone will help you.
Absolutely. I would say that finding me on the Patreon is usually a good course of action, but geez, the last 2 weeks I have been woefully bad at checking that stuff. Although my DMs, I'm still pretty good about checking the DMs on there. But yeah, patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You jump in there, we'll sling you a link. And like you said, people are getting really good at using threads. There's a couple of threads that I read. I think the one about the new CCR, was that the 2004, had something like 69 entries in the thread. So people are getting really good about threading. So that actually made it so much easier to digest some of this stuff, even though I've been away for a while. I think the Microtik channel was... I mean, that took me forever to get through, but still the threading helped keep all that stuff together. So even if you are new, you can kind of catch up pretty quick. Oh, my goodness. I guess any questions or comments, please keep them coming. Thrift, it's always a pleasure to have you on here. I really appreciate it. Your gift of gab is inspiring. I hope to be you one day with less hair. Mikey, thank you for showing up as well. And I guess we'll talk to you guys next time.
Mike. Thanks, Greg.
We're not disappointing. Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.